welcome to the Logistics Tribe. I'm your host, Boris Felgendreher, and today's episode is about the ongoing semiconductor shortage. It's been sending ripples across our supply chains for many months now, with no end in sight. The story of what exactly is going on and what products and industries are affected keeps evolving to the point where I feel like I just need someone to really break down the situation for us. So I pinged Richard Barnett, whom I've known for many years. Richard has a very broad and very deep understanding of manufacturing supply chains. He's currently the CMO at SupplyFrame. SupplyFrame was founded in 2003 with a vision of transforming the way supply chain leaders interact with electronic component suppliers, distributors, and manufacturers. So spot on for our topic today. But before we get started with today's episode, there's some great news I'd like to share about the Logistics Tribe. I am super excited to be able to announce that Gray Orange has become an official sponsor and partner of the Logistics Tribe podcast. Now, if you have anything to do with e-commerce, logistics, fulfillment, and warehouse automation, you probably already know about Gray Orange. And if you don't, I think you should. Gray Orange is really known for combining AI-driven cloud software and smart robots, you know, in warehouses and fulfillment centers. The company's been around here in Europe, in my neck of the woods, for a while now, but they're really making a major push into the market right now. I mean, I hear about them everywhere. For example, Active Ants, the Dutch e-commerce logistics provider, has just opened a sort of very new, brand spanking new, state-of-the-art e-commerce fulfillment center in Belgium, and it's full of Gray Orange robots. And they're working side by side together with humans, and that's really good news ahead of the holiday season. And also, a couple of folks from my network have recently joined the Gray Orange EMEA organization, and to me, that's always a good sign. In any case, if you want to learn more about AI-driven e-commerce automation, check out the Gray Orange website. I'll leave a link in the show notes. All right, and now we're on to the show. Here comes Richard Barnett from SupplyFrame. Enjoy. Hello, Richard. Welcome to the Logistics Tribe. Thanks for being on the program.
Thanks, Boris. It's a pleasure to join you.
Awesome. I'm glad you made it. Richard, as you probably know, the audience of the Logistics Tribe is probably 100% supply chain and logistics professionals. Mm-hmm. It's probably fair to assume that all of those have heard that there's a global semiconductor shortage and crisis going on, and going on for quite a while. Mm-hmm. And if they're anything like me, they've been monitoring the story for a while now, right? For like a year or even 18 months, this has been going on.
Right.
And if you go back to sort of the early part of the story and look at the predictions of what people said back in the days, everybody assumed that it would be over by now, the latest. Mm-hmm. And the story mm-hmm. just keeps going on and keep going on and keeps changing, and more angles and more nuances come into the picture, where I feel like I need someone to give me the crash course on what this whole thing is about. Not for the layman, right? As you would see in a business press, where it's always like sort of
right.
dumbed down in a way where it's like very superficial. I mean, I've read several articles and still not smarter than before. So in the context of our audience being a supply chain logistics professional audience, but we still need somebody who brings it all together. And as I thought about who can I invite, the first person that popped into my mind was you, because you have such a strong expertise and experience in everything supply chain, automotive, and now in electronic supply chain. Maybe before we start, just give us a very, very short version of your background, then it becomes probably very obvious of why you're the perfect candidate that I pinged.
Sure, I appreciate that, Boris. I mean, obviously, I'm also passionate about this issue, you know, in terms of engaging with supply chain professionals, logistics leaders, transportation leaders, et cetera, to understand, you know, what's happening at a little bit deeper level, what some of those root causes are, some of the key trends and dynamics. Yeah. And to your point, you know, just by way of background, I started, you know, getting excited about supply chains and, you know, optimization of supply chains and integrated supply chain management back in the late 90s. I actually started working with a company called i2 Technologies, kind of really at the forefront of supply chain management, really as a new category. We had this kind of convergence of both process and strategy change going on, but also, you know, this application of new technologies, right? So at the time, it was around supply chain planning optimization, but later in my career, I worked at companies that focus on different aspects of this challenge, right? Whether it's the B2B integration aspects, or how do you have collaborative supply management, working at E2Open, working through a channel or working through a, you know, multi-tier supply chain? How do you have a business network-based approach for visibility and for exception management and for collapsing lead times and reducing inventory buffers? And then, you know, we also worked together at GT Nexus, and there was a tremendous amount of work around thinking about how do we continue to evolve the notion of, you know, logistics integrated more in supply chain and the order management flows and multimodal, you know, visibility. And as a community in supply chain, we've just made tremendous progress in many aspects of this over the last, you know, 5 to 6 years. I mean, it's just, you know, it's really kind of cool to see it kind of come together in terms of really getting to global, you know, visibility, you know, that's these new platforms. And, you know, but I've always had this passion also for the high tech industry, because it was always one of the earliest to, you know, leverage outsource contract manufacturing and global logistics providers and be part of that broader globalization trend, particularly with manufacturing in China. And that's really been fascinating to watch unfold, but it has also brought a tremendous amount of new challenges to how do you manage and operate with agility, with resiliency, you know, in that global supply chain. And I had an opportunity to kind of more focus in more recently in direct materials management and in what are those decisions that are made in new product introduction, even before you launch to manufacturing, and then sort of activate the new supply chain that you're designing with each product that you're building, right? And I think folks miss that idea, right, that they're directly tied together. And I became the chief marketing officer at Supply Frame, which really focuses on particularly the global electronics value chain with what we have, what we call this design to source intelligence platform and network, where we're looking at, you know, combining sort of engagement with engineers and supply chain professionals on websites, you know, where they're doing vertical search or community insights. And it's really cool, like taking all this digital exhaust and then doing something with it, you know, having new predictive insights around what's going on with new design cycles and what's the leading indicators of demand, you know, and all these kind of, again, it's a network driven kind of community driven platform approach. Yeah. And then we have SaaS solutions that help companies make better decisions and de-risk particularly product design and drive resiliency in that stage and then manage those bills and materials, those product life cycles all the way through. And so we've really been in this weird position of being like on the front lines of watching and monitoring exactly what unfolded when COVID hit. So we can talk a lot more about that, but I mean, just to give you a little bit of an overview of my background, you know, my passion for this topic, but really more interestingly, just very recently, having this unique front row seat to everything that's been happening. It's been fascinating.
Yeah. And also maybe people know the name Supply Frame through the recent headlines that you guys made, because you were just recently acquired by Siemens, right? The big, gigantic German
company.
That's
right. That's right. We're part of the Siemens family now. We're all very excited. I mean, we entered a process earlier this year, you know, and Siemens was really intrigued and interested around the synergies as were we. Not just within, you know, sort of Siemens portfolio of software solutions, really around design, you know, EDA and sort of product lifecycle management. Many people don't know Siemens as a software company, but they're a substantial software company in their own right. We joined that digital industry software group, but there's also this interest in Siemens globally to understand what we've done at Supply Frame around digital marketplace models, business models, and how they can apply that same learning to, you know, how what they're trying to do to transform, you know, new forms of solutions that are more network and marketplace driven for their global customers. And so that's a really exciting opportunity to collaborate with the broader Siemens company.
Yeah, awesome. Exciting times. So, yeah, well, let's jump right in. Let's jump into our crash course here. And to set the stage, and so I want to focus most of the time, obviously, on the most acute crisis, you know, exacerbated and started and triggered by COVID. I mean, that's obvious, but maybe quickly set the stage and describe to us the situation right before COVID. What was the semiconductor market looking like before that? Was it already in a situation where there was more demand than supply? Was it a glut? Was there more supply and demand? Was it balanced? What did the situation look like before shit hit the fan, so to speak?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really important point, because we saw this even before COVID hit, but I think a lot of folks sort of not really close to the overall dynamics in the industry sort of had a false confidence that demand and supply were in alignment. You know, this is a very normal market, you know, everything's fine. Mm-hmm. And the reality was there was a pressure cooker you know, a bomb ticking, you know, in a lot of ways underneath the hood. In terms of supply demand match, you know, and the sort of cycles of growth in demand in all these downstream industries with the actual constrained supply and lead times and commitments that were being made just around foundry and fab capacity, much less kind of the roadmap of semiconductor companies and the evolution of kind of the high tech industry and value chain overall. You know, and the big story there, right, is just the general electrification and digitization of everything.
Yeah, I mean, everything, yeah.
You know, as consumers, you know, as, you know, business leaders in manufacturing, et cetera. I mean, every new product, you know, everything from, and there was a joke about the chip shortage impacting dog collar, you know, smart collars for, you know, for pet owners, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like that was a big issue, you know? You know, we see this in smart connected devices and experiences, you know, in every industry. I mean, whether it's precision agriculture, where you have harvesters that are, you know, being automatically driven down a specific path based on the optimized weather patterns and satellite imagery, et cetera. You know, and the folks that make harvesters and big ag equipment generally are what I call heavy metal. You know what I mean? They're not necessarily electronics geniuses, but this is the way that you differentiate and create new value is digitizing those products and services. I mean, the same, we talk about this, you know, in industrial equipment, in medical devices, right? It's not just in consumer electronics and high tech and communications and data centers. And then obviously, right, the center of our discussion is really around automotive, where, you know, like passenger vehicle, and trucks, and then even heavy trucks now are increasingly becoming electrified, not just EVs or autonomous driving, but just everything about these, you know, these cars and trucks are basically computers on wheels. And so that demand drive, including 5G and telecommunications, you know, which is a really long ramp, but a huge driver of demand, all of that was about to come online, like anyway, like regardless of COVID. Yeah. And you know, while it was healthy for the overall semiconductor industry from a forecasted sales and growth, generally they were still riding a very tight game where they were only committing to new capital capacity when they had a really high confidence, they had forward-looking demand, you know, and they would do this kind of in waves, right? So we have this inherent cyclicality upstream in the electronics value chain, particularly around semiconductor because it's so asset intensive. That you just, you know, you've got to raise additional capital. Every new foundry, every new fab's cost generally is increasing 20-30%, you know, every year, every technology change and transition. So we already were facing a lot of challenges and we were in the wrong stage of the cycle, in the capital expenditure cycle around semiconductor at the same time that COVID was just about to hit. So that's kind of a general setup.
Yeah, yeah. And if I understand you correctly, it's really hard to get new additional facilities online and to ramp up production quickly is a major challenge, right? So what you're describing is they're basically constantly out of sync. By the time you make the decision to ramp up production, by the time it comes online, you know, the economic cycle for whatever product may already be on the downslope. So you're always sort of chasing the tail, so to speak. You're always in that sort of weird moment where those cycles are out of sync. And that's been going on for a while, you're saying.
Right. Yeah, it's true. And, you know, I mean, if you just look at some of the data, right? So an average new fab, you know, for say ICs and chipsets, you know, for these chips that we're talking about, you know, depending on the sort of technology area you're in, so level of sort of, you know, nanometer level sort of technology sets, right? So you have some wafers, you know, and diodes, I mean, some wafers and fab production that is geared towards, you know, sensors, et cetera, that don't have to be, you know, the smallest possible, you know what I mean? And you have the new M1 chipset for Apple or Intel's new lineup or NVIDIA and AMD. They're constantly pushing the envelope on the smallest, you know, sort of level of lithographic, you know, printing and management of integrated chipset design. And that brings along all the semiconductor equipment that's super highly specialized around it, has long lead times to build and is really complicated. And so all of this build means that, you know, to bring a new fab online, you know, is somewhere between 2 to 4 years. And, you know, you're making a bet on a market that's maybe 3 years out, right? And so you might be hitting it just right in terms of an inflection point, a new technology cycle coming into place, or you might get it slightly wrong and you need to repurpose demand and use that capacity for different reasons. So there's a lot of variability around those cycles. Mm-hmm. It's never perfect. And we were already behind that curve, you know what I mean?
Got it.
Okay. And then we fast forward to sort of the COVID moment.
Yeah. Yeah, that's probably the hardest thing to really wrap your head around, understand the fact that, you know, by now you would think like, okay, what's the issue? Like, why haven't you ramped up production? Because this is the opportunity of a lifetime. Why don't you just crank it up to level, you know, 11 and just take advantage of the situation? But as much as they want to, they probably can, right? Because of all the reasons you just described.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let's jump into COVID. What happened, you know, during the, sort of the, when shit hit the fan during COVID, what dynamics started to play out then?
Well, I think this is something that supply chain professionals, right? We're actually pretty close to like the, you know, so the front lines of what we were watching happen, right? Cause it was very disruptive, very, very quickly. Right. So the first wave you saw of COVID as it sort of started in China, you know, Wuhan and then the region and then China shutting down, responding to it very quickly. And then the ripple effect basically as it started to spread, you know, across the Americas, Europe, you know, Africa and Asia, the rest of Asia. You know, the first wave was that you had production shutdowns. You had, you know, production facilities going to lockdown, production stop, you know, workers being, you know, furloughed, et cetera, just to get a sense of how do we make it more secure, safe? How do we bring production back online? You know, all of that kind of in every area it hit lasted for about 45 days to 60 days at the minimum, right? So we watched China actually manufacturing go offline and come back online between 30 to 45 days in many key industry and factory areas within China, which is incredibly resilient. I mean, they really were doing absolutely their best to try to contain this thing. Mm-hmm. But then the other big impact is you had everyone go into, you know, work from home or, you know, stay at home orders, right? In different major, you know, particularly urban areas, et cetera. And that meant kids weren't going to school. And it meant we were trying to figure out how to work from home. And it meant, you know, we had to, you know, use e-commerce and mobile services. Massive shift, like overnight externality, right? Nothing driven by normal organic market, anything, right? Around the consumption and need demand for, you know, work at home equipment, you know, my HD camera, you know, for doing, you know, web conferences was, you know, impossible to find. Like a guy on my team, IT lead, was just a superstar. I have no idea still to this day how he found one for me that was a good proper HD level one, but he found one, you know? And everyone was scrambling.
Did he get a promotion right after?
Yeah, totally, right. I mean, it's just, you know, it's magic man, you know? I don't know how he did it, right? He's got his sources. But everyone was in the same boat, right? And we were also taking kids and trying to figure out, oh my God, overnight, how do we do distance learning? You know, we need extra laptops. We've got, you know, whole families, you know, in their various days, you know, in some corner of the, maybe an apartment, you know, trying to all work from home. Incredibly stressful. And then, you know, you want contactless delivery. Restaurants are shut down. So you have all this massive explosion of e-commerce. And you have a bunch of things that now have no demand, like overnight. So anything that feeds into commercial real estate, into manufacturing, you know, plants that were shut down, and more importantly, consumer demand in general for certain things like cars, right? Because no one was driving anywhere, you know, anyone who had plans, maybe to buy a new car, that's a big investment decision, you know, with all the uncertainty, you want to wait, you have no idea what your impact is to your job, your family and everything else. So you've got this huge demand and mix change that happens overnight, where certain areas that were very run rate, very boring, like accessories for laptops, you know, just total run rate demand, spiked overnight. And then on the other hand, you had, you know, massive committed forecasts and supply chains that were all geared for a specific maybe seasonality or forecast for the rest of the year, particularly in automotive, just turn off almost immediately, like overnight. And so, you know, what happened was is that you have this huge demand mix change, and it's occurring across multiple supply chains, right? So, you know, again, as supply chain professionals, we know that there's a different fast-moving consumer goods, you know, speed, velocity, packaging size, you know, distribution network sort of profile, mode profile for transportation, totally different from, you know, what you see in the sort of very repeatable kind of locked-in, stable capacity and utilization of every lane, of every kind of, you know, receiving dock, in particularly in automotive, which is really built around just-in-time, just-in-sequence, like a continuous flow. You know, material, parts, suppliers, et cetera, all the way through final assembly, out through a dealer network. All of that got disrupted, you know, very, very quickly. And it had a big, massive, what we call bullwhip effect and acceleration of change that impact the whole value chain like overnight.
Yeah, and what did the automotive manufacturers in particular, because they're particularly hard hit, and a lot of the story around the semiconductor shortage is focused around automotive because they got clobbered, they got hammered, right?
Yeah.
Talk to us about what their cardinal mistake or what their reaction was that sort of exacerbated their situation. When demand dropped for automobiles, and then what happened? How did they react, and how did they miscalculate the situation?
Right. Well, I mean, I think that the first domino, if you will, to fall was generally the OEMs when they saw demand fall off very quickly. And so any kind of local market prediction, wherever they were selling cars through a dealer network, et cetera, immediately said, yeah, demand's fallen. We can't even have people on site. You know what I mean? We don't have a safe way for people to preview cars. People are not, online orders even went down immediately, all the early indicators. So what they did was they just immediately decommitted for both their, production schedules, right, on output volume and on their overall committed demand as they aggregated it across their dealer networks. And then they, because they are engineered, the supply chain, the automotive supply chain is really structurally engineered to optimize, minimal inventory holding and push almost liability for lead time and performance and quality and all those good things upstream at each tier. You have these OEMs, you have these tier ones that kind of build sub-assemblies, whether it's transmission and chassis, and electrical harnesses, or it's in the newer modern systems around mobility and computer vision, LIDAR, all of these new technologies, right? They all have specialization at the tier one or at the tier two. Mm-hmm. And then they're buying upstream from either distributors or directly from key suppliers and semiconductor companies. And they are all built on the forward demand of the OEM. So as soon as that demand was decommitted and there's a huge liability associated with holding in the inventory that's of high value that's not committed, the dominoes just rolled back super fast. No one in that chain really, and I'm overly simplifying, but at a high level was incented to hold strategic inventory, to hold the extra liability based on the uncertainty. And the financial models were very, very difficult for the OEMs to buffer that immediate shock to the system. There's no, sort of specific incentive programs or by capital budget outlays or long-term contract agreements that are built in the system. That's a shock absorber that allows and incents for managing this disruption. So it just, the ripple effect was massive. It took almost no time for it to hit every key player upstream. But the rest of the market wasn't standing still. So it's an interesting, I think that's the big sort of early wave that we saw happen from, March of 2020, really, really just keep rolling through even November and December, where you actually saw for the first time the visibility of the chip shortages now impinging on production, right? So that those first 6 to 8 months were really the interesting window to look at.
Yeah, and so they canceled all the orders for semiconductors from the manufacturers in Taiwan and wherever. And what happened to that production capacity that the chip manufacturers had produced? They shifted it to other demand, right? They just gave it away. They sort of just shifted and it went away.
Right. Yeah. So this cannibalization, if you will, right, of that available demand or that order lead time or that supply is really interesting because, and this is one of those things, again, that not everyone kind of understands or fully appreciates, right? But the same audio ICs, the same resistors, controllers, diodes, et cetera, that go into a car or light vehicle truck are the same things that go into a PlayStation, wearables, consumer electronics, data centers, et cetera. Electronics is one of those really interesting industries where you have this mix of a few very high value, typically like, individually designed components or processors or capabilities, even displays maybe, right, that are done in partnership with a couple key lead suppliers. But the majority of what you're purchasing, assembling, and designing into a PCB board or to an assembly is coming from standard components. And we track, for example, over 600 million standard components, and we look at their risk rank, we look at their life cycle, we look at their real-time inventory, availability, lead time, pricing changes, and all of these form, fit, function equivalents, right? So there's oftentimes a lot of components that can be built by one or more suppliers, or there's parts that are sort of slightly different but can kind of be used in the same design if they're designed in correctly. And that's the thing, right, is as soon as that downstream demand for automotive decommitted and you saw this spike in the need for, you know, everything tech at home, basically, and all the, you know, indirectly all the mobile services, you know, internet-based services now for data centers, et cetera, now they're spiking. That all consumed available inventory that was the same inventory, the same products, the same parts, the same capacity that generally was being committed by either the OEMs or their tier one suppliers.
Yeah, and probably even worse, the situation that as much as the automotive manufacturers are dependent on the chip manufacturers, it's not really the other way around, right? So the chip manufacturers don't really need the automotive market as much. I mean, they need it, and there's a lot of volume goes into that market, but the other part that you're describing, everything else that's not automotive, is a much bigger client base, much larger volumes for the chip manufacturers, if I understand correctly, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the I sometimes refer to it as the tale of two cities, right? That the automotive value chain is sort of split between heavy metal, generally speaking, and like, you know, super fast clock speed, you know, electronic design, digital services, right? And, you know, the automotive industry is sort of geared for the OEMs feeling like they've got a tremendous amount of leverage on the spend and the lead times and production of heavy metal part of their supply chain. And right? You've got these very long-term relationships from everyone from, you know, engine manufacturers, transmission alternators, even tire manufacturers, right? I mean, just locked in, you know, Bosch, Conti, et cetera, in Germany with all the major German OEMs. I mean, that's it's a super integrated, you know, sort of success criteria. These companies are very locked in. In electronics, that's not the case at all. The clock speed on the technology lifecycle and components, you know, is 3x, 4x faster than the life cycle of a lot of these sort of major heavy metal key components and systems that are put into a life cycle of a you know, an automotive program family, let's say a platform, for 5 to 7 years, right? And a consumer electronics could be 18 months, you know, or even less, right? So you've got this massive shift in time. The other big issue is that automotive OEMs, the automotive value stream, not for without good reason, want the highest quality parts and components, the highest reliability at the lowest cost. Right, because they are such a mature industry, they optimize for cost all the time, but they don't want to get, you know, cost trade off to quality or reliability. They have very high expectations, right?
Yeah, I mean, some of it is governed by law, right? I mean, some components you just can't compromise on. It's one thing if your PlayStation breaks down; it's the other part if your whatever your airbag or something doesn't function. You know, so the quality standards.
No, it's true. You got you've got consumer, you know, risk. You know, you've got these are regulated industries. To your point, by every major. Sort of, authority, sort of domain, right? Whether it's at a regional level or a country or the state level, right? You know, all there's highly regulated. It's true of medical devices as well. It's very similar. So there's a high cost to compliance. They want the lowest cost at the highest level of reliability. And they have the lowest relative volumes for almost anything else that's being built. So like, just look at the new iPhone 13 launch, right? You know, the projected unit volume sales is in the hundreds of millions, right? For any new, the most popular car platforms, light truck platforms, say a Ford one, you know, F-150 in the United States, for example, or many of the Toyota, Honda, et cetera, you know, sort of products globally, you know, maybe they'll hit 100,000, you know, for that product model type, you know, in a year, right? Or the life cycle maybe is max 200,000, right? It's 1/10 to 1/1000th of the total top line volume. And so if you're competing for, you know, I want allocated capacity and lead time. And by the way, I want the lowest cost. And by the way, I want the highest level of reliability. And it may include you in the liability of these downstream uses, right? If your component fails, then maybe you're on the hook, right, for a failure in the car. So I'm very expensive to do business with. Yeah. In this demand shift change, who loses there, right? Where are you going to prefer, right, to shift your capacity? You're gonna shift it around. I mean, they don't want to totally turn it off because they don't want to lose any of that valuable business because it's a really, really important part of their business model. And key semiconductor companies have somewhere up to 40-50% of their total demand generally sourced from automotive. I mean, it's highly concentrated, right? But you lose out when it's an open market dynamic. And it's really, you know, it's really a story of industry versus industry, not even company versus company, you know what I mean? And it's a story of multi-tier value chains that, you know, where incentive alignment for liability and for lead time commits and everything else is stress tested. And that's exactly what happened during COVID, is we saw all of the faults in the chain, you know, all the fragility, all of the lack of incentive alignment, you know, just get exposed in a big way.
And the automotives got hammered, right? I mean, there's not a single automotive company that didn't have to hold production and didn't, you know, suffer year-end results and bottom line is affecting every... I mean, even to, I think, just a couple of days ago, I heard that Volkswagen is still impacted. They still have to cut back expectations and production hold and all kinds of stuff everywhere. Not a single one. Or is there one? Am I missing one? Was there somebody that was in a better position for some reason or another, or was just got lucky, or were they all equally hit? What about Tesla, for example?
Right. So I think Tesla's a good one to look at. Any of the pure play EV companies, I think it was one of the most interesting areas to look at early on, because they weathered the storm pretty well versus the other OEMs. And I think Toyota was the other one that's interesting, because it looked like they were going to not be impacted. They sort of survived the first wave of impact on production schedule shortfalls, et cetera, that really started in November. And they just a month ago announced that, nope, that finally caught up to them. Mm-hmm. You know, they're projecting 40% reduction in production volumes over the next 12 months. You know, I just market others that, you know, track the automotive industry, estimate that there's upwards of $80 to $100 billion of you know, new purchase sales that is lost, you know, because of the component chip shortage, just in the first 12 to 18 months. And it's unbelievable.
Yeah. So Richard, and one of the things that is obviously also very important is this regional concentration of the manufacturers of these chips, right?
So that's right.
The big elephant in the room is this TSMC, right? This Taiwanese chip manufacturer. Talk to me about where this supply chain is sort of concentrated very locally in the geopolitics that come into play. I think that's a very important element as well here.
It is. It is. And we've seen that the geopolitical tension and thinking around this, like, you know, become more of a central topic for, you know, discussion, both in the United States and in China, but also just globally, you know, across Germany, across, you know, Japan, Korea, et cetera. Like it's across the board. So let's just kind of have an overview here, again, crash course. You know, about 60% of global semiconductor capacity is really sourced through what's called, you know, the foundry or fab providers. There's about 40%, which is provided through what's called IDMs or integrated device manufacturers. And that used to be the norm. So what I mean by an IDM is a company like Texas Instruments or Intel that has their own foundry and fab capacity, their own manufacturing capacity. And those foundries are kind of very purpose-built for managing the mix of, you know, components, chips, et cetera, that they're, you know, building, including kind of semi-custom chipsets for some customers or applications, as well as very more general purpose processors, whether that's, you know, microcontrollers or, you know, integrated circuit design, you know, IC chipsets that are generally used in different downstream applications. So when we look at TSMC, they're the largest of the foundries, and the majority now of semiconductor companies, early startups, et cetera, are what we call fabless, which means they design the chips, you know, they manage, you know, the commercial go-to-market, the brand, et cetera. They have their own engineering teams, but they basically don't manufacture the chipsets themselves. They have both the foundries and then the, you know, the actual fabrication process, including end tests and assembly and packaging, all go through third parties. Sometimes that's one lead foundry, sometimes that's a multiple, you know, key players in that chain. And the companies that have, you know, where that capacity is expanded outside of Taiwan, where TSMC has about 80% of their, 90% of their employee base, 80% of their total capacity, is really in mainland China, Korea, and then in new parts of the United States, for example. So you do see a slow diversification of fab and foundry location capacity, but the main concentration points for both semiconductor equipment that's used for fabrication for these foundries, as well as the foundries themselves, is predominantly in either Taiwan, mainland China, you know, and then it kind of diversifies out from there. Traditional fabs and foundries that have been located in Singapore, the United States, and in different parts of Europe.
But that's really where you see this high concentration, and you see this emerging tension between particularly United States and the West and in China, because what's also been happening in parallel, but also COVID, it was an accelerator of this, was that, China, has, has really increasingly looked at, like many countries, the need for their own chipset design capability, their own, access to semiconductor equipment, et cetera, not just for commercial reasons, right, to support Chinese manufacturers, or in the case of the United States, U.S. semiconductor companies or U.S. manufacturers that rely on semiconductor. But it's also, challenged this idea of export control and, how do we kind of protect our industry base? How do we form new public-private partnership, industrial policy strategies? In China, that's kind of very normal with how they, each five-year session, they create a new five-year plan, sets out broad goals, each of those 5 years, and really helps to structure investment and prioritization. And China just completed that five-year plan right before going into COVID. And one of the key announcements was that the strategic interest that they have to, develop and expand their overall semiconductor design and manufacturing base, to really protect and have their own, limit their dependencies on the outside. And then Taiwan, which is potentially under dispute in terms of its relationship to mainland China, et cetera, falls right squarely in the middle of that conversation, because Taiwan is outsized in its importance to the global electronics value chain, mostly because of TMC, but also UMC, and it's been its foundry capacity and technical know-how and everything that goes with, the expertise over 20, 30 years, is concentrated in Taiwan. So, that has really shined a spotlight on the geopolitical and fragility or concentration issues that, were exposed again, and you saw, I remember reading reports in, November and December, for the first time ever, you had U.S. government, Commerce Department, German, ministries, et cetera, coming flying into Taiwan to broker negotiations with TSMC to advocate for the needs of their specific companies. And, it's almost just crazy that you think a geopolitical pressure like that would actually shift anything, overnight, Because this is there's no easy moves here. It's not like people are hoarding chip supply, It's just the entire, capacity of the entire industry is out, it's fully utilized. So yeah, it's fascinating.
Europe is an interesting keyword here. Where is Europe in all of this? I mean, how dependent are we here in Europe? I think somewhere in the range of less than 10% is actually produced here in Europe. That's a dramatic dependency on foreign countries and foreign supplies. Like, what's going to shift there? What's going to happen there? What's your prediction there?
Well, I mean, I think there's different perspectives, right? I think one is, the EU allows for the aggregation of some, national level interest and manufacturing level regional interest to be represented and advocated for in different forums. Whether that's in trade agreements, whether that's in, industrial policy sort of preference. We saw that in aerospace and defense, very natural that you have that kind of clustering and support, because if it's about national or regional security, I think we're going to see more of that mindset shift into commercial semiconductor applications upstream. Because again, going back to this, the setup conversation, many of the same chipsets and components that are used in automotive are also used in aerospace and defense and used in national defense agency spending, right? And new design of either weapons or, radar or monitoring systems, et cetera, all is sharing from the same upstream supply pool. So there's this double down sense that we need to protect and have either our own regional capacity or somehow have new forms of long-term agreements where we can negotiate and manage and have visibility to that risk and that, those available supply. Now, up to this point, I don't think those issues were really, I mean, they were on the radar screen of everyone. It's not like, generally speaking, either, commerce departments or ministries of trade or those within defense, were unaware of the dependency and reliance on electronics, but generally is very indirectly supported through, you know, investments in, you know, in higher education, or, you know, supporting, you know, regional tech centers, or, you know, it's kind of indirect support, right, for the R&D stage and for, you know, developing a rich ecosystem for either design or for the application of these products. Now we're really looking for the first time at where are the sources of supply? Where are the locations of these foundries and fabrication centers? What risk is associated inherently with those locations? And it's not, by the way, just geopolitical interest. It's also weather. I mean, as a quick sidebar, one of the biggest issues we watched last year that wasn't in the news was, you know, TSMC's access to water, because the water is very intensively used in foundry production, fabrication. And the sort of stockpiles of water aquifers, you know, co-located next to these major foundry locations was at its lowest point ever recorded because of 2 years of sort of less than, you know, expected typhoon rainfall, you know, absorption. And so luckily the typhoon season generated just enough water to sort of keep everything on track. But that could have been the next part of the story, was a drought in Taiwan disrupting the global supply chain, regardless of COVID. You know, that would have been
another close call. Yeah.
Yes, another close call, right, in this whole story. So anyway, it is really interesting.
And on top of that, they're sitting on top of a fault line, right? On top of an earthquake fault line. So they're also at risk
the
for
ring of fire, for major, right? I mean, the ring of fire, we saw that in Japan, but the ring of fire is, you know, Taiwan and, you know, and rest of parts of Asia are on the same, you know, set of risk factors for volcanic activity, for earthquakes, for, you know, underwater earthquakes, and et cetera. So it's there's a lot of risk factors to look at here.
Yeah, just to going back to our preferred automotive industry conversation here, what are some of the major learnings that the industry will take away from this crisis? What are some of the major changes that you predict will happen as a consequence of what we've seen the last 18 months or so?
Well, you know, you've seen some really interesting forward-looking announcements for those OEMs that are sharing what their plans are internally. We have kind of the visibility, some of those internal plans and evolution. But it's interesting just to see what's in the public domain, right? So you've got Ford spinning this into, maybe this is the opportunity, particularly in the US, for the market to shift to, you know, build to order, right? Where you just go into a dealer and you select what you want to order and then you wait 5 weeks and get delivery shipment. Now that's much more common in Europe, where you're familiar with, but you know, that's partly a—
Well, if it was 5 weeks, it would be okay, but it's typically much longer than, right? If you do it that way.
But in the future, they're hoping, right, that they get to more normal lead times. And then they're saying, like, look, why do we go back to giving allocation to dealers, you know, of 100 cars a month? Maybe we do 15, 20, right? And then we just take the rest of that, you know, as individual orders. Now, I don't think, you know, US consumer preference is going to make that model work. But theoretically, for the first time, you've seen the US automotive OEMs talk about how this is a viable strategy, where for years and for many different pressures in the dealer network, et cetera, that was considered unthinkable, right? You know, so that's interesting, right? You got GM just coming out recently and talking about how, you know, they're rethinking how they manage, you know, long-term supply planning, you know, component sourcing, their design teams, and they're really, because there's silos everywhere in these OEMs around how those teams work together, both by geography, by department, you know what I mean, et cetera. And they're very typically bureaucratic and slow moving. And so they've got to transform themselves internally and really rethink, okay, where is the internal collaboration and where is the shared intelligence need to happen? So if we see an issue like this emerging, how do we get out of it? How do we reduce our response time from weeks or months to days, right? And that's a really interesting goal and perspective. And it's coming very top down from C-level, you know, board level discussions, et cetera, because literally they've had to write off, you know, X billion of US dollars or euros over the last few months, right? I mean, nothing more could be more important right now. But I think structurally, that's where we're going to see the more interesting, like, shift over time, is this, you know, movement away from just in time and just in sequence is always good all the time, right? I think there's this notion that you need to sort of segment and understand, you know, how many internal supply chains do you actually have? It's not one monolithic supply chain, right? The lead time, the just in sequence for painting, for, you know, loading a transmission and an engine, you know, on the assembly line, that's great, right? And you can get to stay ahead of it. But for components, it's a different story, right? So how do we organize ourselves? How do we have shared visibility? commercial agreement control, and this is typically called in procurement or sourcing, you know, a notion of directed buy, where I'm telling you, buy from commercially, buy from this semiconductor supplier, but I'm going to negotiate a long-term agreement with that supplier and pre-negotiate the price or cost, versus a kind of a turnkey, I just want visibility to what you're buying on my behalf and what the updated lead times are, because it impacts me, even though you need to buy it, own it, and take the margin gain and risk associated with the cost associated with that. We're moving into a model where, you know, increasingly we need shared visibility around design and the design chain, and then link that into the shared visibility of what's happening in sourcing and supply chain, particularly managing, you know, the balance between cost, quality, and risk, you know, and the economic incentives around, you know, how do you judge success of a procurement and sourcing team, or how do you judge success of a new design team, needs to come into alignment. And I've found that that's, you know, hard work in so many companies, because there's so much inertia to not roll down and look at those changes and implement them. There's a tremendous amount of change management, particularly in a lot of automotive companies that are very stable and mature in their business processes. You know, sometimes these groups and organizations have been in place for 20, 30 years, right? So how do you rethink all of this? And I think that that's really an interesting challenge, but opportunity for a lot of the leaders in automotive OEMs themselves. And my final comment would be, you know, what we're doing at Supply Frame is an example, I think, of what is really the keys to the future. And it builds on what we talked about earlier, which is this wave of innovation that's happened around the near-term supply chain, the final mile, right? The visibility of everything that's from order to, you know, shipment to intermediate receipt, you know, and inventory, right? We've got a lot better about, you know, linking together, you know, networks of logistics, 3PLs, providers, et cetera, and then linking that to my, you know, my order systems and my inventory supply chain planning systems for just-in-time or VMI, et cetera, these models. We've made great progress there. The next big wave, right, you know, that links to a lot of the same, you know, thinking, right, networks, and it's not about my enterprise data, it's about sharing visibility and control across these different business partners. That next wave is really going to be about shared visibility across contract manufacturers or tier one suppliers and external design teams, all working with a single source of truth around what's the change in risk, what's the, you know, the longer lead time visibility that we have now to supply capacity, cost drivers, et cetera. And so that we're synchronizing and trying to respond to that as much as possible, because there is this opportunity to get smarter, faster, and to reduce the bullwhip effect of just the demand propagation signal challenge, just creating massive variability in supply lead times. In general, we've got to get better and collapse that variability as we work through the structural impact of what's happening right now. There's just very limited degrees of freedom today, but over the next 2 to 3 years, that will free up.
Yeah, super interesting. So maybe as a last point, I would love to get your predictions for what's going to unfold first across the next 12 months. I know it's difficult. Predictions are always ripe with uncertainty. That's just the nature of the beast. So just your predictions for the next year, how this whole thing will unfold and how it will solve itself. And then maybe also like a broader outlook, maybe for the decade even.
I think that's a great question, Boris. And as you say, it's always, there's no crystal ball. It's always very difficult to make these sort of forward-looking predictions. But the one area I can make some confidence is that we actually are tracking what the true long-term lead times are, because of the 26 weeks to 35, you know, 40 week lead times on, you know, just generally new chips that, you know, are going to be ordered and going through the fab, you know, process all the way through, right, the value chain. We actually can see that the constraints are going to extend into at least the first half of 2023. But mm-hmm. the pattern that we're seeing, yeah, and it's much longer. I think the market is just catching up to that reality right now. You know, Alex Partners, other analysts that cover the automotive industry just recently have updated their forecast for, you know, the overall volume of vehicle productions, you know, 2022 kind of outlook in 2023. And they've revised everything down, and the total opportunity cost of lost sales has now been estimated, has gone from $100 billion to over $200 billion. And that's just in automotive, right? It's not including consumer electronics and all these other related industries. So I think the overall outlook is this is not going away anytime soon. This is a broad-ranging, highly interconnected, impacting multiple industries kind of effect that we're going to see in kind of a wave approach. So it's not like a one-time event that then just gets resolved. It's going to kind of, you know, have these sort of, you know, strange, it'll shift in terms of what key sub-commodities are being impacted. It'll shift in terms of what industries or sub-assemblies or key suppliers are being impacted. And then it'll have, you know, and it's just the fragility in the market is then allowing for other factors now to make a big difference. So, you know, whether, you know, looking at the energy crisis in China, for example, you know, understanding the next typhoon season in Taiwan that might impact TSMC, you know, the overall logistics carrier, you know, network, the, you know, ocean, you know, port congestion, all these issues will stabilize, but the compounding of those different factors makes it also really difficult to, you know, again, crystal ball time, you know, really predict. I think the takeaways are interesting. I think this is a unique moment. I don't think this is just another Sendai, you know what I mean, impact, you know, where we just sort of had to recover and then, you know, we're good again. You know, this is something where there's a rebalancing of thinking around the trade-off between, you know, just in time or, you know, VMI pull-based strategies that, you know, are balancing, you know, the lowest level of inventory possible in a network to a new strategy that says, hey, let's rethink where do we have strategic buffers? You know, how do we have long-term agreements with key suppliers? How can we pool inventory and reduce the risk, you know, and have that flexibility to kind of decide what key components or key, you know, key elements of supply need to be pooled and shift that in and out, you know what I mean, as a strategic buffer. I think that flexibility in the supply chain is going to be really important. And that has interesting implications for any logistics and transportation sort of, you know, supply chain network design professionals and teams. You know, there really is a new openness to like take a fresh look at the network, you know, look at the trade-off between, you know, where you're pooling inventory, what, you know, multi-mode sort of strategies do you have? It's not about lowest cost anymore now. It's this really interesting dynamic where you have to really balance cost, risk, and lead time dynamically. And, you know, any assumptions around stable lead times and key supply markets has kind of gone out the window. So any planning system that has static lead times, you know, absolutely needs to be, you know, updated and reviewed more dynamically. You know, and I think that this balancing of, you know, looking at budgets for like sort of expedite costs, you know, for part shortage, you know, sort of expedite shipments is not like this sort of exceptional thing that we try to minimize. It's now becoming a primary mode of inbound fulfillment. And so that actually creates a lot of flexibility where teams have been under a lot of pressure from cost optimization perspectives to now actually look at flexibility and agility in their transportation logistics network, not just, you know, trying to move everything from air to ocean and call it good. You know, that's just not going to work in this market. So I think those are the implications.
Richard, awesome conversation. I'm so glad I invited you for this crash course and everything semiconductor shortage related. I know I made the right pick. Fantastic. Thanks for that crash course. I very much appreciate it. I hope our audience does too.
Thank you so much, Boris, for the opportunity. It's a critical issue. It's fascinating. It's challenging. You know, I think we just need to keep, you know, sharing insights and new thinking because it, you know, it's this is not business as usual at all, you know, across the world and, you know, across every function within supply chain. So I think it's all about, you know, taking our best thinking and you know, challenging our assumptions and trying to get more agile, more resilient, you know, across the board.
Yeah, fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Richard, thanks again for being on the program. Talk to you next time.
Thank you so much, Boris.
All right. That was the Logistics Tribe podcast episode with Richard Barnett from SupplyFrame. I hope you enjoyed this crash course in the current semiconductor shortage. If so, please subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss any of the future episodes. I'm Boris Felgendreher. Until next time.